Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 404, Sunday, July 25th, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
HTTP 404. The HTTP 404, or 404 not found, 404 404 error page not found, or file not found error message is a hypertext transfer protocol standard response code in computer network communications to indicate that the browser was able to connect to a given server, but the server could not find what was requested. The error may also be used when a server does not wish to disclose whether it has the requested information. The website hosting server will typically generate a 404 not found web page when a user attempts to follow a broken or dead link. Hence, the 404 error is one of the most recognizable errors encountered on the World Wide Web. And here we are in the 404th episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast, which, at the rate things are going, may well surpass the main Sea Realm podcast, as I just don't get the free ones out very often. But in this episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast, I'm going to do a little retro work. I am going to do three segments, one on each of the Sea Realm podcast guests who appeared most often on the Sea Realm podcast over the year. I haven't actually gone back and counted them. You know, with so many episodes and so many episodes sort of lost in this lacuna when I moved from one hosting service to another and had to drastically downsize the number of files that I could host for a given price. You know, there's a big hole in the Sea Realm podcast archive now, so I have not gone back to count. But when I think of the Sea Realm podcast and I think of the guests who have appeared most often, I think you'd probably agree the names that come to mind first are going to be Jim Kunstler, Dmitry Orlov, and John Michael Greer, although Doug Lane has been on many an episode as well, but sticking with the, you know, where are they now? Sort of now that the peak oil Dumosphere has splintered and the various prophets of it have gone their separate ways and adopted, in some instances, different messages than the ones that they were promoting before, but mostly just, you know, further elaborating their own personal reality tunnel in response to feedback that they get from their audiences. So the first is John Michael Greer. I know I named him last, but it was actually the fact that his book, The King in Orange, The Magical and Occult Roots of Political Power, has been sitting on the back of my couch next to the easy chair where I sit and watch endless hours of YouTube. And I hadn't picked it up and read it in a couple months. Well, I picked it up again this morning and started reading. And the content, you know, it's based on things that he's published previously online, and much of that I've already read. So this is all very familiar stuff. But one thing that really came across to me, well, before I tell you about, you know, my experience of the book, let me read you the editorial copy on the back cover. Magic and politics seem like unlikely bedfellows, but in The King in Orange, author John Michael Greer goes beyond superficial memes and extreme partisanship to reveal the unmentionable realities that spawned the unexpected presidential victory of an elderly real estate mogul turned reality TV star, and which continue to drive the deepening divide that is now the defining characteristic of American society. Greer convincingly shows how two competing schools of magic were led to contend for the presidency in 2016, and details the magical war that took place behind the scenes of the campaign. Through the influence of a number of occult forces, from Julius Evola to chaos magicians, as well as the cult of positive thinking, Greer shows that the main contenders of this magical war were the status quo magical state, as defined by the late scholar Ion Quiliano, which has repurposed the manipulative magic techniques of the Renaissance magi into the subliminal techniques of modern advertising, and an older, deeper, and less reasonable form of magic, the magic of the excluded, which was employed by chaos magicians and alt-right internet wizards, whose desires coalesced in the form of a frog avatar that led the assault against the world we knew. examining in detail the magical actions of Trump's opponents with insights on political magic from occultist Dion Fortune's War Letters, the author discusses how the magic of the privileged has functioned to keep the comfortable classes from being able to respond effectively to the populist challenges, and how and why the magic resistance, which tried to turn magic against Trump, has failed. Showing how the political and magical landscape of American society has permanently changed since the 2016 election cycle, Greer reveals that understanding the coming of the King in Orange will be a crucial step in making sense of the world for a long time to come. Okay, so I haven't read enough of the book to get into the magical stuff that this description really, you know, dwells on. And he hasn't really started talking much about, you know, the occult. He's still talking in terms of what people who are not really interested in the occult would consider normal social discourse. And of the four people that I'm going to compare and contrast, I'm told compare and contrast is a unnecessarily repetitive phrase in that comparison means comparison of similarities and differences, so you don't really need to add contrast. But I'm going to talk about, you know, the points of view of Jim Kunstler, Dmitry Orlov, John Michael Greer, and myself, which all pretty much coalesced at one point in time and then has diverged, although maybe they were never as coalesced as they seem to be on the surface. But all of us, I mean, of all of us, none of us are, you know, none of us are down with the majority of, well, let's just say it, Democrats. As John Michael Greer would say, salary class Democrats who are just wedded, like white knuckle wedded, to this narrative of, you know, working people, particularly white men of, you know, the wage class, are just evil, just racist, bigoted, sexist, you know, rape culture promoting, egomaniacal little Hitlers, every one of them. And of course, the people, you know, who promote this with the most ferocity tend to be white men themselves. I just don't understand that mentality. I honestly don't want to understand it. I don't want to inhabit it. It seems diseased. But the point being, in the ways that the four of us have diverged since our seeming, you know, moment of ideological coalescence back in the, I guess, early 2010s, none of us has gone full SJW or even vaguely in that direction. But of the four of us, I would say that the person who is most sympathetic to the concerns, the purported concerns of the crybully class, is John Michael Greer. But you know he's not one of them. I mean, you know he's not one of them, right? So therefore, when I read a passage from his book where he's very generously articulating their point of view, I would say he is steel-manning, which is the opposite of straw-manning, their position in this early chapter in the book, The King in Orange, The Magical and Occult Roots of Political Power. So I'm not going to read a whole chapter to you, even though I'm going to relay a chapter's worth of content from the book. So let me just start off by summarizing John Michael Greer's three classes, or four classes, I guess. Three main classes of human beings in the American economy and the economy of, you know, similar countries, countries with similar economic structures as the United States. You might even say integrated, intertwined economic structures with the United States. They are the investment class. These are people who do not toil for their labor. They deploy capital in certain ways and, for the most part, are well compensated for this task. Then there is the salary class. These are the technocrats. These are the people who service the investment class. Below the salary class are the wage class. These are the people who sell the hours of their life in return for money. And then at the very bottom of the hierarchy, below the wage class, are, pick your term, people who have given up, you know, people who never really had even the possibility of participating in the wage class, you know, either through disability or through extreme deprivation in their upbringing, you know, people who were, say, on the school-to-prison pipeline. I don't remember John Michael Greer's official, you know, label for this class of people, but basically it's the very poor, the people at the very bottom who are dependent. There's no illusion that they're supporting themselves or, you know, pulling their own weight. And while it's easy to imagine that the people who have benefited the most from the, you know, the changes in the global economy over the last half century are the investment class, John Michael Greer says, nah, not so much. I mean, the investment class, they just get paid to have money, but with interest rates near zero, that doesn't amount to much. yeah, they're fabulously wealthy. They were fabulously wealthy before. They're fabulously wealthy now. They're doing fine. You don't have to worry about them, but they're not the primary beneficiaries of globalization or the automating away of previously well-paying occupations for the wage class. So John Michael Greer's position is that the people at the very top and the people at the very bottom, I mean, it's always great to be the king, and it always sucks to be at the bottom of the hierarchy. Those two positions haven't changed, really. What's changed dramatically is the relationship between the salary class and the wage class. Now, if you just talk about the working class, well, both the salary class and the wage class, they're both the working class. But their fortunes have diverged dramatically. Since the middle of the 20th century, when, at least in the United States, that was the moment of most widespread prosperity. In the waning years of the 20th century and in these early years of the 21st century, the salary class, the people who don't sell the hours of their life, but sell them in blocks of, you know, year or 2 years or however long their contract is, and whose compensation isn't dependent on the number of clocked hours at the job. It's just a given. They have a salary and benefits. They've done very well. And it is definitely in their material interest and in their psychological interest, you know, their own psychological well-being, to not think about how they've done in relation to the wage class. The people who are, in the most literal sense, trading the hours of their lives for dollars. And so people in the salary class, you know, having a common socialization experience in college, have, as Thaddeus Russell puts it, you know, they have led the bifurcation into, you know, those of the ruling class who are of college, you know, ruling class and their servants, and then, you know, the rest of us. And really, culturally speaking, I'm much more of that ruling class mindset. I'm just, you know, a curmudgeon about it. But then there is everybody else, you know, the residuum. Those who didn't go to college or who did go to college and just focused on learning what it was they needed to make money in the world and didn't absorb a lot of the culture and values of the people who are of college. So the common culture of the people who are of college is to be feminist and decidedly anti-racist. And the best way or easiest way, it would seem, for them to feel good about their own prosperity and to not care about the diminished prosperity of the wage class is to accuse the wage class of having forbidden, contemptible, retrograde opinions on the topics of race and gender, which is to say that the working class is chock full of vile bigots, racists, and sexists. And if all of those people like Donald Trump and conspired to get him elected in 2016, then in the eyes of those who are of college, the reason for Donald Trump's election in 2016, simply put, was racism and sexism. So now, reading from page 58, John Michael Greer writes, "Words like racism and sexism deserve a closer look here, though." So I'm trying to record this on a beautiful, sunny Saturday afternoon, and the air is just abuzz with the sounds of motorcycles and loud cars. There is no avoiding it. This is the time when I have the focus to work, so I'm going to have to push on through, and I'm not going to stop reading when loud vehicles go by. John Michael Greer writes, "Words like racism and sexism deserve a closer look here, though. These, and terms like them, are much more ambiguous than they look at first glance. Each such term conflates at least three different things. Unpacking those here will help us get a clearer view of the landscape of American inequality and its impact on the rise of Donald Trump. The distinct factors that need to be pulled out of these portmanteau words are privilege, prejudice, and injustice. Let's start with the last. A policeman guns down a black teenager in response to an action that would not have gotten a white teenager shot. A woman who is raped has a much lower chance of having police and prosecutors bring the case to trial than a man who suffers an assault. Until quite recently, two people who loved each other and wanted to get married had to run a gauntlet of difficulties if they happened to be of the same sex that they would not have faced if they were of different sexes. Those are acts of injustice. Prejudice is a matter of attitudes rather than actions. The word literally means prejudgments. The judgments we all make about people and situations before we encounter them. Everybody has them. Every culture teaches them. But some people are more prejudiced, more committed to their prejudgments, and less willing to reassess them in the face of disconfirming evidence, and some are less so. Acts of injustice are often motivated by prejudice, and prejudice often results in acts of injustice. But neither of these equations is exact. I've known people who were profoundly prejudiced, but who refused to act on their prejudices because some other belief or commitment forbade that. I've also known people who participated repeatedly in acts of injustice who were just following orders or going along with friends and didn't care in the least one way or the other. Then there's privilege. All right, now if you are a white man, and I know most of you listening to this are, the word privilege might get your hackles up preemptively. And nothing John Michael Greer writes here in the next couple of paragraphs is going to soothe those hackles. So just keep in mind, this is for a good cause. John Michael Greer writes, "Then there's privilege. Where prejudice and acts of injustice are individual, privilege is collective. You have privilege, or don't have it, because of the categories you belong to, not because of what you do or don't do. I'll use myself as a source of examples here. I can walk through well-to-do neighborhoods, for instance, without being hassled by the police. Black people, by and large, don't have that privilege. I can publish controversial essays online without being bombarded with rape and death threats by internet trolls. Women, by and large, don't have that privilege. I can kiss my spouse in public without having some moron yell insults at me out the window of a passing car. Gay people, by and large, don't have that privilege. I could fill the next half dozen pages with a listing of similar privileges I have, and not come close to running out of examples. It's important, though, to recognize that my condition of privilege isn't assigned to me for any one reason. It's not just that I'm white, or male, or heterosexual, or grew up in a family on the bottom end of the salary class, or was born and remain able-bodied, or what have you. It's all of these things, and many more, taken together, that assign me my place in the hierarchy of privilege. This is equally true of you, dear reader, and of everyone else. What differentiates my position from yours, and yours from everyone else's, is that every station on the ladder has a different proportion between the number of people above it and the number below. There are, for example, plenty of people in today's America who have more privilege than I do, but there are vastly more who have much, much less. Note also that I don't have to do anything to get the privileges I have, nor can I get rid of them. As a white heterosexual man from a salary class background and the rest of it, I got assigned nearly all my privileges the moment I was born, and no matter what I do or don't do, I'll keep the vast majority of them until I die. This is also true of you, dear reader, and everyone else. The vast majority of what places you on whatever rung you occupy in the long ladder of privilege is yours simply for being born. Thus, you're not responsible for the fact that you have whatever level of privilege you do, though you are responsible, of course, for what you choose to do with it. You can, after all, convince yourself that you deserve your privilege, and that less privileged people deserve their inferior status. That is to say, you can choose to be prejudiced. You can exploit your privilege to benefit yourself at the expense of the less privileged. That is to say, you can engage in acts of injustice. The more privilege you have, the more your prejudices affect other people's lives, and the more powerful your acts of injustice become. Thus, advocates for the less privileged are quite correct to point out that the prejudices and injustices of those who have more privilege matter more than comparable acts by those who have less. Which is to say, your sins as a straight white man outweigh the sins of people who have more disadvantaged badges on the front of their chest. That was my aside. That was not Michael. That was not John Michael Greer. John Michael Greer continues, "On the other hand, privilege does not automatically equate to prejudice or to acts of injustice. It's possible for the privileged, who, as already noted, did not choose their privilege and can't get rid of it, to refuse to exploit their privilege in this way." It's possible, crashingly unfashionable as the concept is these days, for them to take up the old principle of noblesse oblige, the concept widely accepted in eras where privilege was openly recognized, that those who are born to privilege also inherit definite responsibilities toward the less privileged. I suppose it's even possible that they might do this and not expect lavish praise for it, though that's kind of a stretch, American culture today being what it is. These days, though, most white heterosexual men from salary class backgrounds don't think of themselves as privileged, and don't see the things I enumerated either as privileges. I'm going to just pause there and say, my mother's parents were farmers, my father's parents, my father's father worked a variety of industrial jobs in New York City. His mother was an Irish immigrant married to, you know, the son of Irish immigrants, doing manual labor in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Greenpoint in the early half of the 20th century. Both my mother and my father were the first in their families to go to college. My father worked for the federal government as a Secret Service agent. He had a salary. So, you know, I could say, like, I don't get a salary, but I could say that I'm from a salary class background. But, you know, that was one generation. That was the one and only generation in my ancestry that included people who went to college. Well, it wasn't the only generation because, you know, I went to college, as did most of my cousins, which is to say the kids of my mother's brothers and sisters. Why do I say all this? I guess it's because I just feel this societal condemnation. Every time one of my characteristics as a privileged being is listed, it feels like a condemnation, and there's a part of me that wants to deny it. So when it comes to male, can't really deny that. White skin, well, looked in the mirror recently. Heterosexual, yeah, pretty sure. Cisgendered, you know, I'm reluctant to even consider that a thing, but yes. But salary class background. My father earned a salary, but every other male in his line was wage class. And my mother's side were farmers. Two generations went to college. I suppose my oldest son has done a semester of community college. Anyway, a bit more from the book here. John Michael Greer continues. These days, though, most white heterosexual men from salary class backgrounds don't think of themselves as privileged and don't see the things I enumerated earlier as privileges. This is one of the most crucial points about privilege in today's America. To the privileged, privilege is invisible. That's not just a matter of personal cluelessness or of personal isolation from the less privileged, though these can, of course, be involved. It's one of the most significant magical spells we're under. The mass media and every other aspect of mainstream American culture constantly present the experience of privileged people as normal, and just as constantly feed any departure from that experience through an utterly predictable set of filters. First, of course, the experience of the less privileged is erased. That sort of thing doesn't actually happen. When that fails, it's dismissed as unimportant. Well, maybe it does happen, but it's no big deal. When it becomes clear that it is a big deal to those who have to cope with it, it's treated as an occasional anomaly. You can't generalize from one or two bad examples. When that breaks down, finally, the experience of the less privileged is blamed on the less privileged. It's their own fault that they get treated like that. If you know your way around America's collective non-conversation about privilege in the mass media or in everyday conversation, you've seen each one of these filters deployed 1,000 times or more. What makes this interesting is that the inevitability of privilege in modern America isn't shared by that many other human societies. There are many more cultures, past and present, in which privilege is right out there in the open, written into laws and openly discussed by the privileged as well as the unprivileged. The United States used to be like that as recently as the 1950s. It wasn't just that there were Jim Crow laws in those days formally assigning black Americans the status of second-hand citizens, and laws in many states that gave women second-class status when it came to a galaxy of legal and financial rights. It was all over the media and popular culture, too. Open any daily newspaper back then, and the society pages detailed the difference in privilege between those people who belonged to the elite and those who didn't. For reasons rooted in the cultural convulsions of the 60s, though, frank talk about privilege stopped being socially acceptable in America over the course of the second half of the 20th century. That didn't make privilege go away, of course. It did mean that some specific forms of privilege based on race and gender, such as the Jim Crow laws just mentioned, were scrapped, and in the process, some real injustices did get fixed. The downside was the rise of a culture of double talk, in which frank talk about class privilege and class prejudice, above all about the privilege enjoyed by members of the salary class and the prejudices they displayed toward the wage class, was shoved completely out of the collective conversation of our time. That act of suppression had a profoundly political subtext. In the aftermath of the 60s, the wealthy elite, occupying core positions of power in the United States, offered a tacit bargain to politically active members of the dulcimer-playing generation discussed earlier. Individuals and groups who were willing to give up the struggle to change the system and settled instead for an improved place within it suddenly started to receive corporate and government funding, and carefully vetted leaders from within the movements in question were brought into elite circles as junior partners. Those individuals and groups who refused these blandishments were marginalized, generally with the help of their more compliant peers. If you've ever wondered why environmental groups such as the Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth changed so quickly from scruffy, fire-breathing activists to slick, well-funded corporate enablers, this is why. Equally, that's why mainstream feminist organizations, by and large, stopped worrying about the concerns of the great majority of women and fixated instead on breaking the glass ceiling, which is to say giving women who belong to the salary and investment classes access to more privilege than they have already. The core demand placed on former radicals who wanted to cash in on the offer, though, was that they drop their demands for economic justice. And American society, being what it is, that meant that they had to stop talking about class issues altogether. Okay, I'm going to stop reading there and go to summarizing and commenting. But you see what he's done there. I mean, he's given a very thoroughgoing, fair shake to the idea that straight white men have a lot of unearned privilege. We don't like to hear it. It's not comfortable, particularly when we feel like our status, you know, it's, for some of us, it's economic status, for others, social status, is diminishing. We don't want to hear about our privilege. And John Michael Greer has just put it in a way there that, personally, is as distasteful as I find talk of white privilege. I can't argue with what he's laid out there. Or I choose not to. You know, I could probably seize on something, but it would really be nitpicking. But then he's taken it, and he's taken the history of, you know, how we've come to this present moment to frame the conversation as one in, you know, as an explanation for why those who are of college, you know, why those who are dedicated defenders of salary class values have seized on this narrative that the wage class is full of racists and bigots. You're not allowed to talk about economic injustice. You're not allowed to talk about class struggle. You know, if you're a good member of the Blue Tribe, you don't talk about those things. Those are for the radical weirdos, you know, off in the fringes, the Marxists, the anarchists to talk about. You tolerate them, you know. They're the crazy, gone too far to the, you know, the light side for their own good faction of your tribe, or at least, you know, they're more adjacent to you than are the MAGA hat wearing, knuckle dragging red tribers. And in the book from there, John Michael Greer goes on to talk about the rescue game. Now, I know I've talked about this in the past, so I'm going to explain it very briefly, because I suspect most of you could probably explain it, you know, just for me naming it, the rescue game. The rescue game has three roles. You have the victims, whose job it is to suffer. You have the persecutors, whose job it is to persecute the victims. And then you have the rescuers. The rescuers have two jobs, or two moves in the game. They can either express sympathy for the victims, or they can punish, either verbally or physically, the persecutors. Now, the rescue game has three phases. First, there is the pin the tail on the persecutor phase. This is the first phase. This is where, and you know, all of these phases are ongoing. The rescue game has overlapping cycles, but in the first phase of any cycle is the pin the tail on the persecutor phase, where various groups of would-be victims make their appeals. They articulate their grievances against various persecutor classes, and it is the rescue class who comes in and picks, they anoint the next respectable victim category. And in so doing, in allying themselves with that class of victims, well, they have selected or pinned the tail on the persecutor class in this instance. Now, to get away from the current moment, John Michael Greer jumps back a century and he talks about the victim game as it was played in the mid-19th century, just after the Civil War. In this round of the rescue game, the victims were poor whites. The victimizers were poor blacks. And the rescue class, you know, the wealthy whites, swooped in to condemn the blacks, regardless of what they did, for victimizing poor whites. You know, if black people went to school, if they educated themselves and tried to move up the ladder of, you know, move up the vocational hierarchy, well, then they were waging an assault. They were invading the sacred precincts of the few ways in which poor whites could advance themselves. If they did very little and just, you know, succumbed to their circumstances and worked for too little money, well, then they were undermining the wages of hardworking white, you know, but hardworking but poor white people. The system of condemnations was full of double binds like that. No matter what you did, you were a victimizer, and that's part of the rescue game. It doesn't matter what you do. If you are in a particular class, any action you take within your class will be interpreted as you making the one move, or in the case of the rescue class, their rescuer class, the two moves that are open to you. So no matter what you do as a victim, your actions will be seen as suffering, because that's all the victim course, that's all the victim class can do is suffer. Doesn't matter what you do. If you are in the designated persecutor class, any action you perform will be considered persecution of the victimized class. And if you are in the rescuer class, anything that you do, you know, if you are in that category, no matter what action you take, it will be construed as either lending comfort to the victimized or shaming or punishing the victimizers. Now, one important feature to note is that the rescuer class is always composed of people who are in a superior social position to the members of the victim class and the victimizer class. And so a cynical person might say that the rescue class, what they're really doing, is keeping various factions below them at each other's throats and thus protecting their own status. You'll recall the rescue game requires that somebody participate in each class, and yet the rewards of being in the persecutor class are few and not very compelling. So the persecutors tend to check out early. Now, the benefits of being in the rescuer class are pretty clear. You get to deflect all blame from yourself and direct all culpability for the status and experience of the victim class to the persecutor class. A class in which you, by definition, just by pointing the finger at it, you are not a member of that class. Clearly, you wouldn't be complaining about racism and sexism if you were a racist or a sexist, right? You wouldn't be pointing at other white people and accusing them of these sins if you weren't completely free of them yourself, right? Well, obviously not, but that's the implication. But what are the benefits of being in the victim class? Well, I'm going to read a bit more. John Michael Greer writes, "The benefits that go to people who are assigned the role of victim are more substantial. Victims get to air their grievances in public, which is a rare event for the underprivileged. And they also get to engage in socially sanctioned bullying of people that they don't like, which is an equally rare treat. That's all they get, though. In particular, despite reams of the usual rhetoric about redressing injustices and the like, the victims are not supposed to do anything or to expect the rescuers to do anything to change the conditions under which they live. The opportunities to air grievances and bully others are substitutes for substantive change, not, as they're usually billed, steps toward substantive change." So getting to articulate your grievances and beat up on members of the victimizer class is all you get if you're in the victim class. It is understood by everybody involved that your material circumstances will not change as a result of this intervention by the rescuer class. You just get to feel good, or feel better. John Michael Greer continues, "The vast majority of the benefits of the game, rather, go to the rescuers. They're the ones who decide which team of victims will get enough attention for rescuers to start a game. They're the ones who enforce the rules, and thus see to it that the victims keep on being victims and persecutors keep on persecuting. Nor is it accidental that in every rescue game in American society today, the people who get the role of rescuers are considerably higher on the ladder of social privilege than the people who get the roles of victims and persecutors." So I said that each iteration of the rescue game has three phases, the first one being pin the tail on the persecutor. The second phase of the game is show trial. This is where the persecutors are singled out, they are charged, evidence is laid against them, and this is the reward phase for the persecuted group or the victim group. This is where they get to articulate their grievances, you know, and face their accusers and humiliate them with the support of a superior social force, you know, on their side. But eventually, the show trial phase comes to an end, either when, you know, the persecutors, the selected persecutors are thoroughly discredited and bullied into silence, or they just decide they don't care to play that role anymore and exit the scene entirely, in which case you need to find somebody else to play the persecutor role. And thus, we enter into phase three, the circular firing squad. John Michael Greer writes, "In this final phase, The need for a steady supply of persecutors is met by identifying individual victims or rescuers as covert persecutors. Since players thus accused usually try to defend themselves against the accusation, the game can go on as before. The victims bring their accusations, the newly identified persecutors defend themselves, and then the victims and rescuers get to bully them into silence. The one difficulty with this phase is that each round of the game diminishes the supply of players and makes continuing the game harder and harder. Toward the end, in order to keep the game going, the players commonly make heroic attempts to convince or coerce more people into joining the game so that they can be outed as persecutors. And the range of things used to identify covert persecutors can become impressively baroque. The difficulty, of course, is that very few people are interested in playing a game in which the only role open to them is that of being accused of violating a code of rules that becomes steadily more subtle, elaborate, and covert with each round of the game, so that they can be bullied into silence. Once word gets out, as a result, the game usually grinds to a halt in short order due to a shortage of players. At that point, it's back to pin the tail on the persecutor, and on we go. So in talking about how, you know, where the sort of archetypal Sea Realm guests have gone since they were archetypal Sea Realm guests, and, you know, how they have diverged from one another. So, you know, the implication being how the various parties have diverged from one another, you know, and if I'm one of them, then how they've diverged from me. But I have to say that I don't read John Michael Greer's current work as regularly and consistently as I read the Archdruid Report. And while I'm interested, I mean, more than just vaguely interested, more than just passingly interested, I'm actually interested in occult ritual and occult practice. JMG is into it at a much deeper level than I am, and I just haven't followed him there. And I'm as far from my interest, like experientially, I am as far from my ritual magic polarity as I ever get. I'm very much in my, you know, rationalist materialist mindset these days. That said, you know, I start every day with meditation because I believe it has tangible, quantifiable health benefits. But the point being, I don't have any major disagreements with John Michael Greer, except, you know, maybe just in matters of aesthetics and you know, in terms of our visions for what's possible for the human future. I mean, we are radically different. But in terms of dealing with the here and now, differences in style at most, but substantially, I agree with most everything I read from him when he's commenting on, you know, the culture war or politics or social trends in the United States or economic trends in the United States. In fact, if we're talking about places where the three archetypal Sea Realm guests never did really agree, I first talked to John Michael Greer. I mean, the very first time I interviewed him was after the publication of his book, Apocalypse Not. Basically arguing against the fast collapse scenario. So JMJ, as long as I've known him, has never been a doomer in that simplistic sense of there's going to be a fast collapse and it's happening tomorrow. Next, I'm going to talk about Dmitry Orlov. First, I'll say where I won't say that I necessarily disagree with him. It's just I have a different focus and a different, much like, you know, where I would say I disagree with John Michael Greer. You could say a lot of it is aesthetic differences, not so much substantive differences in, you know, statements that we regard to be true or false. So with Dmitry, and, you know, looking back on Dmitry's collapse work and his peak oil-themed work, even back then, you know, looking back on it, I see that there was a strong anti-American sentiment to it. And he's still talking about collapse, but, you know, he's so pro-Russia now, just so openly pro-Russia, pro-Putin. He seems to be articulating a world vision whereby Russia is the ascendant power, that their demographic collapse really is a great thing. It means they have lots of space per person, you know, in which to expand. It's kind of hard to do if you're not having babies, though. Anyway, and that Russia is this not only, you know, a legacy military power, but an ascendant high-tech military power, which is so sophisticated and so experienced and battle-hardened and just adroit at what they do, that they would destroy the United States in any military conflict. Part of what he's talking about there is actually something that is an element in Kim Stanley Robinson's book, The Ministry for the Future, in that there are these strike capabilities that I forget exactly what they're called, but it's missiles that are incoming from a lot of different directions until just a fraction of a second before they reach their target, at which point they all coalesce into a single strike point. So it is, you know, a very hard kinetic strike against a target, but the incoming missile cannot be shot down. They're either hypersonic or, you know, they're just swarming in a way that there really is no main incoming missile to hit or intercept until the very last second. So I think, you know, the specific weapons that get used in the novel are at this point still hypothetical, you know, still science fiction military tech. But there are examples of it, precursor models in current use, or so it is claimed by people like Dmitry Orlov. And, you know, it's certainly beyond speculation. It is known, it is demonstrated that China has hypersonic cruise missiles, which can take out a U.S. aircraft carrier and which the United States does not have the capability to intercept at this time. You know, that sort of technology, which renders the enormous expenditure that the United States makes on its Navy not obsolete, but certainly far less omnipotent seeming than it was in the past. You know, these technological changes will continue to overturn the apple carts of, you know, the previous big players. And that's something that, you know, if you really want a detailed historical analysis, I would say go to Dan Carlin for that. You know, look for any Dan Carlin episodes, hardcore history episodes, where he's talking about the attempts that Russia made to freeze military technology, to say, you know, military technology will, like the guns that we use, the artillery pieces we use, all the military technology that we're using right now is the standard. It cannot be innovated upon. It cannot be advanced technologically any further than it is right now, because they knew that any further technological advancement would probably favor the European powers over Russia. And, you know, you simply can't do that. You simply can't say, I have a winning position right now. We're writing that into law so it will always be the case. It won't always be the case. It is a temporary state of affairs, and the ongoing technological advancement, particularly, you know, in this instance, in military technology, will create sudden reversals of power, or at least, you know, quick changes in relative power of the different players. But I think, you know, what the war in Iraq and basically the war on terror has demonstrated very conclusively is that the United States, which spends more on its military than everybody else combined, has all of these high-tech assets, you know, eyes in the sky in the form of drones and satellites and global strike capability and a network of bases, you know, 800 military bases around the globe with very thorough integration with the host countries of those bases and, you know, continent-spanning intelligence and information exchange networks, that even with all of that, it's very difficult to just go into somebody else's country and tell them how to do things, regardless of how poor and technologically, you know, backward they are. Look at Afghanistan. You know, with all of the capabilities and all of the infrastructure and all of the training and the institutional knowledge and just the sheer limitless amounts of money that the U.S. military has to throw at defeating poor, uneducated, poorly equipped, but ruggedly determined people, it's really hard to invade somebody else's country. So I think that regardless of how the U.S. military armaments, you know, might be rendered less powerful due to technological change over time, the fact that so many Americans have AR-15s will mean that the United States will be practically unconquerable. So we may flounder internationally. You know, our buildup of military might may be rendered irrelevant and be proved, you know, a dramatic, just show-stoppingly stupid squandering of our resources. But that doesn't mean that anybody else can invade the United States any more than the United States can go and invade, say, the Philippines or Sudan. You know, We can bomb the shit out of them. We can certainly reduce their capacity to project force to nothing. But to go into the country and demand that everybody do things the way that we want them to do and contrary to the way that they've been doing them and they would choose to do them if given their druthers, the United States has demonstrated that that's very, very difficult, regardless of how much military power you have at your disposal. Okay, that was an aside. Hadn't planned to talk about any of that. What I do want to talk about, so the places where I disagree with Dmitry, they're not so much points of disagreement, like statements of fact that he would say are true and I would say are false, more that I'm just not into the, you know, reflexively anti-American talk. Given, you know, the other courses, the other ways that the 20th century could have gone, I think a globe-spanning military empire governed by the Americans is far from the worst-case scenario. Very far. Are there utopian scenarios that were technically possible that we missed out on? Maybe. But I'm happy to have avoided much worse scenarios. So that's really just my point. I won't even say of disagreement. You know, it's a point of aesthetic disagreement. But he posted an essay several weeks ago now in which he describes his political ideology. And he says that he's a leftist, totalitarian, right-wing capitalist, socialist, state capitalist, monarchist, Stalinist, democratic, internationalist. Wow. What does that mean? Well, he says he's a left-wing totalitarian in that he thinks that some things cannot really be left to for-profit businesses and must be managed by the public sector. And when, you know, what he's talking about here are natural resources, land, water, fuel or energy resources in particular, but also road building, communications, public security, defense, social infrastructure. And I guess here he's referring back. He's not talking about social media. He's talking about, you know, transportation, infrastructure, mass transit, recreational facilities. And crucially, from my perspective, he includes in this category access to medical care. That cannot be left to the market. He says these all need to be administered by a strong central government because these are not things that can be allowed to be distorted by for-profit enterprises or the private market. That said, he considers himself to be a right-wing capitalist and that he thinks most anything else, you know, other than energy resources, land and water management, public defense, imposition of public order, say policing, you know, other than a small handful of things that he thinks really do have to be administered at the public, you know, at a centralized civic level, he thinks pretty much everything else, the government should stay out of it. Particularly, the government should stay out of food service. It should stay out of clothing, footwear, dog grooming, auto repair, really all manner of things. And Vermont, you know, hippie blue state Vermont is kind of a libertarian paradise in that respect, in that, like, when I moved here, I was living with Olga. She's a massage therapist. She had to be licensed to practice massage in New York State. No such license is required in Vermont. Anybody who wants to massage somebody else can do so. And if that other person wants to give them some money for it, no problem. So Dmitry describes himself as a right-wing capitalist in that respect, but he goes further to say he's an extreme libertarian in that he thinks there should be no income taxes. And I absolutely agree. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution of the United States which indicates that the government can claim a piece of your bodily movements, like your bodily movements, walking, bending, lifting, pushing, pulling, that the government has any right to assign a monetary value to those movements and demand that you pay a percentage of them, you know, of that value to the government for your bodily movements, which you engage in for money. And I would say that the same goes for cognition. There's nothing in the Constitution that says if I sit down and I think about something to say and I come up with a string of words, which I then put down on paper or I type on the computer or I speak into a microphone, and that goes out into the world and generates interest and people reward me for that, you know, that creative activity. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the government gets a piece of that. And the fact that we live in a world where the government gets a piece of that, and that it is incumbent upon me to prove that the government is wrong. If the government presents me with a bill, a tax bill, and says, you owe this much, in every other aspect of the American legal system, you are innocent until proven guilty, but not in tax court. If the IRS says you are guilty, you are guilty. Full on, point blank, guilty, dead to rights, until you prove otherwise. Dimitri recognizes the absurdity of that position, and I absolutely agree. He also says that he's a socialist and state capitalist. What's he talking about there? I mean, how can you be an extreme libertarian and a socialist or state capitalist? Well, he says pensions have to be paid, roads have to be maintained, and it doesn't matter what the corporations and the super rich feel about that. That just has to happen. So anything that might allow capitalists, oligarchs, big players who have not been invested with any public trust, who have not stood for elections, who have not been appointed, you know, as members of the government, it doesn't matter what they own. It doesn't matter who owes what to whom. If their economic choices and if their, you know, their imperatives, if their projects get in the way of essential public goods being created and distributed, like pensions, like roads that you can drive on, you know, private capital has to lose. Private capital cannot be in a position to override the government in the provision of these basic services. So that makes him a socialist. But to claim that he's a state capitalist as well, he goes further. He says, look, the government should have full managerial control over land, water, resources, particularly energy resources, and it should be able to make a tidy profit doing so. Which is to say that there should be state-run, maybe possibly monopolies, but, you know, state-run businesses which not only turn a profit, but which turn a handsome profit and make a good amount of money. And so you'll notice I'm not reading Dimitri's words here, but when he's talking about how the government should make money, he writes, this revenue is best achieved by strategically setting rates on the use of resources, most importantly, energy resources, which should be commandeered as needed and maintained under direct government control. This will produce the equivalent of a progressive taxation scheme, since the rich consume much more than the poor. This makes me simultaneously a socialist, one of the ones who are always speaking out in favor of progressive taxation, and a state capitalist, one of the ones who believe in a large and profitable government sector. So I think the important thing to point out there is the government raising revenue, you know, generating revenue by instituting fees or taxations or some sort of material, you know, monetary penalty on the use of resources in conjunction with no income tax, no taxing people's bodily movements. This means that most taxes will be paid by the rich because it will be the rich who will be accessing those energy resources. So this combination of extreme libertarianism, fuck taxes, and state capitalism, yes, the government should be able to raise revenue using, you know, the collective goods that we are all invested in, you know, that we all have and can claim some partial ownership in, the mineral wealth in the ground of the nation in which we all live. That belongs to everybody. You know, that's a profoundly anti-libertarian stance, you know, at least according to the sort of knee-jerk assumptions of current American, you know, self-described libertarians. But I think it's easy to argue that such people don't really consider the full implications of their libertarian ideology and apply it consistently and, you know, arrive at conclusions that they don't like. All right, this next point is super short, and I'll just read it verbatim because I can read it faster than I can summarize it. I believe that the government should be formed from the highest quality cadres, responsible, motivated to achieve results, honest, incorruptible, patriotic, and hardworking. This makes me not just a leftist, but an outright communist. And I would say it makes him an elitist, you know, an elitist in as much as the people who have been invested with the public trust and control of resources should be highly competent and highly motivated to serve the public. You know, shades of Plato's Republic here. That the rulers, the military, and the philosopher kings are not allowed to own anything. They cannot get rich. They cannot monopolize the wealth of the nation using, you know, their power as the guardians or as the rulers. They have to serve the public in the name of the public good. And so we should structure our society such that it is impossible for somebody whose primary mentality is career building and wealth generation, we should just make it impossible for them to serve in public office. The structures, the incentive structures have to be aligned in order to attract people who are civically minded, who want to actually administer the country for the benefit of the country. So, number six, he considers himself to be a monarchist, inasmuch as he thinks that there are people who are in what he considers to be honorary positions, which is to say they're not, you know, executive function public positions. They're more figurehead type positions. He writes, people whose positions are essentially honorary and established for the purpose of ensuring continuity and public stability should keep their jobs as long as possible, in many cases until death, and in some cases, such honorary positions should be heritable. This makes me an outright monarchist. Which makes me wonder how much Mencius Moldbug, a.k.a. Curtis Yarvin, he reads. As Yarvin is a self-described monarchist. Number seven, he says he's a Stalinist. He's a Stalinist in as much as Stalin was ruthless in, you know, removing people from power who were either corrupt or incompetent. And as Dmitri writes it, this makes me not just a leftist but an outright Stalinist, since it was under Stalin that public officials found it particularly easy to make the transition from doing office work to working outside with ice pick and snow shovel. Or more likely just to be, you know, buried in a shallow grave, a shallow mass grave. Number eight, he encompasses multiple labels under number eight. He says he's a Democrat in that he thinks elections have their place. As he writes, I can see where voting for a head of state can be useful as a patriotic exercise, an act of acclamation where the mass of the populace can voice their approval for their beloved leader. I can also see how a free and honest public vote is a good mechanism for choosing public officials. This most certainly makes me a Democrat, he writes. But then he goes on to say that if a politician runs with certain campaign promises, and then as soon as he or she is elected, you know, it completely ignores those promises and governs in a way that is not in alignment with, you know, what was advertised in the election, that that public official should be held legally accountable after their term of office has ended, and they should be charged with fraud, you know, if they made obviously false campaign promises. Or, you know, he thinks that a government like that of the United States, if it counts itself as being above international law and goes and invades a country and kills hundreds of thousands of people, that, you know, the leaders who did that should be tried as war criminals. So he believes that he is an internationalist in that he believes that no country or its officials or its citizens should be allowed to place themselves above international law. And in addition to that, he says, if you vote for a candidate and that candidate, you know, starts a war of choice, kills hundreds of thousands of civilians in some other country, that's a war crime. And you are a participant to it because you, the voter, by voting for a particular candidate, this is a personal delegation of your authority and a personal guarantee that you endorse a particular candidate. You think they will do the right thing. If they go off and commit, you know, mass crimes against humanity, you will be charged for those crimes as well as the leader. I don't know that I'd quite go that far, but it certainly has a nice, you know, it's got a nice ring to it. So I will read his closing two paragraphs here. He writes, if there is a key insight to be gained from this discussion, it is this. It is possible to stake out a principled and well-reasoned political position as simultaneously and without internal contradiction, a leftist totalitarian, right-wing capitalist libertarian, socialist, state capitalist monarchist, Stalinist, democratic internationalist. This indicates that what political scientists postulate to be a left-to-right political spectrum into which they attempt to coerce each and every one of us is a bunch of bullshit. Worse than that, it is a blatant attempt to polarize, to segregate by opinion, and then to use divide-and-conquer tactics to nullify opposing opinions. Therefore, in a political discussion, you should feel free to call bullshit and end it right there whenever anyone attempts to introduce polarizing terms such as left and right. Oh, and if you still want to pin me down as to my politics, I am a leftist totalitarian, right-wing capitalist libertarian, socialist, state capitalist, monarchist, Stalinist, democratic internationalist. So, that's where I agree with Dmitry, and, you know, people have asked me about Dmitry on many occasions, and the thing I always want to stress is that he's very enjoyable to interview because he'll take any sort of real-time, you know, off-the-cuff challenge you throw at him. Other people have very strictly scripted talking points that they will not deviate from. And whenever you ask them a question, it doesn't matter what the question is, their only thought is, how do I tie this question to one of my pre-prepared talking points? Dmitry is the exact opposite of that. Throw him any weird curveball and he'll go for it. He'll take a swing. And I really appreciate that. And that's, you know, one of the things that I enjoy most about interviewing him. All right. And that brings us to James Howard Kunstler. So, of the three men, JHK, Dmitry Orlov, and JMG, James Howard Kunstler is the one who is, you know, he's my friend. He's somebody that I've hung out with quite a bit. I like him a lot. He's a fun person to hang out with, and he's just somebody I'm glad to know. I've stayed at his house many times, you know, gotten drunk with him many times, had a good time with him on many occasions. Of the three, Dmitry is the least in that category. I mean, I've hung out with him, Justin Ritchie and Olga and I, and was Seth there? May have been. It was a Sea Realm extra environmentalist gathering, you know, on the dock by Dmitry's boat in Boston Harbor. And Dmitry was at the last Age of Limits conference, which is like a camp out sort of thing. So, you know, I've hung out, gotten drunk with Dmitry, but of the three men, it is with Dmitry that the highest percentage of my conversations with him were either on mic or in preparation for an interview. We've had the least amount of just unstructured social communication. So as I say, Jim's the guy who's my friend, you know? I hang out with him, I enjoy his company. It doesn't matter what he says or writes in his weekly column or on his podcast, or in books. It's not going to change the fact that I like him. But of the three men, he's the one that I probably disagree with the most. One, he's still very much calling for that short-term cascading collapse of, you know, crucial infrastructure. And I just don't see it happening. I mean, if you predict it every single year for 30 years and, you know, on year 30 it happens, does that make you right the whole time? We'll leave that as an open question. But in addition to that divergence of opinion, particularly in his weekly column, or maybe it's a twice weekly column that he writes, and I don't read it, I don't read every single one, but I check in with it often enough to keep my finger on the pulse of it. And it just really seems to be throwing a lot of red meat to the paranoid MAGA crowd. I looked at his most recent, you know, his most recent blog post today, and he seems to have joined the people who champion the narrative that the messenger RNA-based vaccines, you know, the Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson vaccines, are going to kill a large percentage of the people who have been vaccinated with them. He writes that because a lot of the first people to get vaccinated were soldiers, that this is probably going to inhibit U.S. military preparedness going forward because so many soldiers are going to die. And in his most recent Clusterfuck Nation post, he quotes an unnamed medical official. He writes the following. He says, How much are they squelching the actual numbers of deaths directly related to the vaccines? A savvy correspondent with a medical license writes. That's an interesting way to identify somebody. A savvy correspondent with a medical license writes, and then begins a long block quote. The rate of reporting adverse reactions to the VAERS system in the U.S. and Europe is very poor, somewhere between 1 and 10% of actual events being reported. This obviously means that the actual death rate is likely much higher. So I would not be surprised if the real number of vax-induced deaths in the U.S. is in the range of 100,000 or more, much more. This is very reasonable when you take into account the shockingly frequent effects involving myocardial inflammation and blood clotting. Both of these pathologic processes logically stem from inflammation stimulated by massive production of the S1 spike protein by the injected mRNA. The S1 spike protein, as you know, is the inflammation-inducing toxin in COVID infections. There was a major fuck-up by focusing on stimulating the production of S1. They, the PTB, powers that be researchers, thought that the S1 protein was just a marker for SARS-CoV, not the pathogenic toxin. In my opinion, most of the deaths from the mRNA vaccine are going to take much longer via long-term inflammatory damage to the vascular system, including heart tissue, brain blood vessels, etc. Of course, they will deny that such deaths are related to the vax, given the time distance from the injection. Too many people making too much money from the mRNA shot. Those weren't Jim's words, but that was a long block quote that he put into his most recent blog post by an unidentified correspondent who is savvy and has a medical license. So this touches on two things for me. One is that in some respects, I count myself lucky to have found such a select audience for my ongoing efforts and, you know, for not attracting as large an audience as Jim has, because the larger the audience, the more nuts you're going to have in it. And when your audience reaches a certain size, you know, if you've been pandering to the nuts, well, it's going to be disproportionately made of nuts, and the nuts are going to demand increasingly nutty content. You know, and if you get paid for producing increasingly nutty content on demand, well, you're going to do it. And it's a lot easier to do it if you actually believe it. So, you know, there is a feedback mechanism and a financial incentive to genuinely and vigorously subscribe to increasingly nutty points of view. That's one aspect. But the mirror aspect, or the opposing aspect to that, the opposing consideration is epistemological humility. I don't know what the fuck's going on. And because I've had the vaccination, you know, I have a psychological reason to want to reject any narrative which says that everybody who got the shot is going to die, or, you know, a large percentage of them are going to suffer lingering health effects and probably earlier death from systemic inflammation or inflammation of the circulatory system. And, you know, that's what gets most of us anyway, right? It's heart disease. It's what kills most people. Kills a lot more people than cars, bullets, or cancer. So, you know, a prediction like that is one that you can't miss. I mean, you can't miss with that by saying, yeah, in the future, a lot of people are going to die from complications from circulatory inflammation. I mean, that's just, you can't lose with that prediction. That's going to happen, regardless of whether the vaccines play a major role in that or not. So really, there's two issues there. The one is, because I've been vaccinated, I have to recognize that I have a strong but irrational motivation to reject certain categories of stories. Stories about how the evil or greedy or stupid or blundering powers that be, you know, put a lot of pressure on a lot of people to get vaccinations, which it turns out in the long run are not only useless, but actively harmful. Given that, you know, I'm one of the people who rolled up my sleeve and took that shot twice, I don't want to believe that, so I have to recognize that my not wanting to believe it needs to be accounted for. It needs to be addressed in my analysis. And you can put analysis in scare quotes. You will not offend me at all. This is me just trying to make sense of stuff. So I think I'm going to wrap it up there, I guess, with just a little bit of summation. You know, I used to lean on Jim Kunstler, John Michael Greer, and Dmitry Orlov to help me articulate the worldview that I was articulating in the early years of the CROM podcast. I now largely reject that whole narrative, that whole project. And yet, each of these men is still saying things that I agree with, although some of them are saying things that I disagree with, and some are saying things that I don't necessarily oppose. I just don't share, you know, their aesthetic. But since I ended with Jim, and maybe I was a little scant on the praise, I mean, just saying I like the guy, that's kind of backhanded praise. I will say that the actual lifestyle choices that he makes are both, you know, coherent in that they're congruent with the message that he puts out into the world. But I also think that they are genuinely positive lifestyle choices. Like, he keeps a very big, well-tended garden. I just think that's a good thing to do. He plays multiple musical instruments, and he's in bands. Like, he has other groups of musicians that he gets together with, and, you know, they practice, they prepare for public recitals or, you know, gigs, and they perform those gigs. So he's he's not only using music, and I think music is just good for you in general, but he's using it as a social tool to integrate himself into his local, his physically, you know, geographically local community, which I think is great. He's a good cook. He's an artist, you know, and he writes prolifically. He makes his living as a cultural creative, and, you know, for that reason alone, we're on the same team. So none of that is, you know, personal. None of that depends on, you know, just personally liking the guy. Those are just, I think, praiseworthy aspects of his larger life project. And that said, I disagree with a lot of the stuff that he says now, because, you know, I mainly think that he's throwing red meat to the MAGA crowd. And I think the MAGA crowd, you know, while in many, many aspects in particulars, they are justified in their anger, I think they're also pretty nutty. And I think they gravitate to some nutty ideas. And, you know, I think they gravitate to nutty ideas because they're nutty. And as much as I push back against the cry bullies, you know, the SJWs, the people who want to make everything about race and gender so that there is no, you know, no room whatsoever for any talk of economic justice or class-based struggle, I certainly don't want to invest full political authority or, you know, too much control over the lives of other people, you know, into the ones who are indulging in what to me seem like paranoid fantasies about the vaccine. Enough qualifiers there. Seem to me like paranoid fantasies. I could have just said paranoid fantasies. But again, I've had the jab twice, so, you know, I'm highly motivated to disregard those narratives and describe them, you know, to reject them as paranoid fantasies. I recognize that. All right, I'm repeating myself, so I'll stop talking and start editing. Thanks for listening. As always, you know, send me feedback via whatever vector works best for you. Because the C-Realm audience is a small audience, the members of it who communicate with me, they have an outsized influence on what I explore and what I talk about. Take advantage of that if you want to. All right, thanks to all the new subscribers. Not that there's a lot of them, but, you know, there's a slow incoming trickle. And welcome to each of you. Now, most new, I'll throw new in scare quotes, subscribers are people that, you know, have been subscribers in the past. So there's a body of people who have just been subscribed continuously since 2012. We're going on 10 years now. And then there are a lot of people who subscribe for a while, they drop off, they come back a year or more later and they catch up on what they missed, and then they drop off again. And, you know, I've said this a million times and I'll continue to say it. That's absolutely cool. No problem with that at all. I'm happy to see that message from Patreon from time to time saying that you've checked back in again. Welcome back. All right, that's all. I'll talk to you again soon. Stay well.